And today, that means live Q&A. Welcome to Radical Personal Finance, a show dedicated to providing you with the knowledge, skills, insight, and encouragement you need to live a rich and meaningful life now while building a plan for financial freedom in 10 years or less. My name is Joshua. I am your host. Today is Friday, and every Friday, at least every Friday that it can arrange a proper internet signal, we go live, and today is no different. Live Q&A coming up in 15 seconds. I do really love to do these Friday Q&A shows. Any day, any time that I can actually work it out to make it work, then that's when I do. So working out the details on how to do a live show with Q&A, with video, live streaming on the internet, on Facebook, on YouTube, and all over the place. That's today's challenge. But I think we got it worked out. Mark, you're up first. Welcome to Radical Personal Finance. How can I serve you today? Mark. Mark, can you hear me? Okay. We are going to go to the backup plan here real quick. Hang on the phone lines. We're going to switch internet networks and see if we can fix the problem. Just a minute here, guys. Thanks on the live stream. We'll get this going in just a second here. Just go into the backup network here. And let's see if I can get my phones coming in. Okay, let's try again. Mark, can you hear me? Organizer. Mark, you're up. Can you hear me now? Mark, you're up in first plate. Can you hear me now? I can't hear you. All right. Hold on a second, Mark. Looks like that's you over there. Try again.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Now I can hear you. Somehow I had to go to the backup internet network.
Okay, excellent.
And we're there, but we're live now. Welcome, Mark. How can I serve you today, sir?
Great. Excellent. I have two questions for you. I have a house buying question and a side business question for you.
Okay, let's do it.
Do you care which one's first?
Okay, I don't.
Great. So first is, we're preparing to buy a house in roughly a year. I spoke to you previously about this. And so I'm trying to make sure my credit is in the right spot. We are around 770. And the main reason is just our age of credit is too young. And so we just have to wait for that. But the secondary reason is our mix is... not mixed. I've only ever had credit cards. And so I was wondering or considering looking at taking out a quote unquote credit building loan. It would not put a hard inquiry on my credit report, but instead would get reported as a loan. Essentially what the banks do is they give you a loan, they put it in a certificate of deposit, then you quote unquote pay it back until the loan matures. And so it's a way to add in a little different kind of credit. Is that something you're familiar with? Do you recommend it? Does it make any difference? I know it's only 10% of the mix.
Yes, curious your advice on that. So yes, yes, and yes. It definitely is important to have a mixture of the different credit types. And so if all you have is credit cards and you want to improve your credit score, then you definitely want to start by going ahead and moving in the direction of adding in more of a diversity. Add in a car loan, add in a bank loan, add in some kind of installment loan, and that will improve your credit score.
Excellent. That's good to know. Excellent. That was quick. The second question, I have started a new venture. Seen it, the Prepared Expat. And so I've trying to develop it into a kind of side business, have a vision for where it goes. And I'm debating whether to make it written form, a podcast, or both. And I was wondering your advice on how to think through making that decision of medium.
Did you hear at the end of last Friday's Q&A where I talked about kind of my new venture, and I talked with a listener who was thinking about building some kind of local media platform to meet people?
I don't believe I have.
Okay. So let me
give you kind of an overview,
and I'm going to do this quicker because in the last Friday Q&A show, I gave an in-depth overview for a listener who was trying to come up with an idea of how they could connect with their audience and build an overall platform that would help them to make connections. And I talked about the media strategy. I talked about things I regret personally with regard to radical personal finance, things I would do differently. But basically, going forward, if I were starting over again today, going forward, I would not focus on just one medium. I would start with one, and I would try to start with where I'm best. But going forward, I think it's best to focus on multiple media. That's obviously more difficult because it's hard to do all things well, and the skills you need to be a good writer are not necessarily the skills that you need to be a good podcaster. And the skills that you need to be a good podcaster are definitely not the skills that you need to be a good video broadcaster. They're all very different. And so what you've got to do is you've got to develop the ability to work in the different media. Podcasts are really good for building a close relationship with your listeners. They're really hard to get found. They're really hard for people to share them because basically either you are a podcast listener or you're not a podcast listener. And so people don't usually do a very good job of actually sharing whole episodes. So if I were going to do one or the other, I wouldn't. Writing certainly is going to be good. The benefits of writing is much more shareable. It's much more findable. The SEO is going to be a lot better. People can connect with the content. They can look through it very quickly, which is going to help you to attract a broader audience. So the podcast will go deeper, but I wouldn't just do one. I would do all of the above. That's, I think, where we stand in May of 2020 is it's not sufficient to just do one thing. You've got to do all of the above because that meets people in different places. So to the extent that you're able, I would choose where you want to start, but my long-term plan would be to expand into all the different platforms and the different formats.
Okay, that's helpful. That's helpful.
Go back and listen to last week's Friday Q&A, and I cover it in depth on that Friday Q&A of a lot of details of how you can build the different models, and you can leverage what you're doing on different platforms. But that would be where I would send you.
Okay, that would be great.
Cool.
I will go back and make sure I get to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, and good luck with the new venture. Again, Mark's venture is called The Prepared Expat. So you can find him, I know, on Twitter. If you want to find him there, you can find The Prepared Expat and find his website. He's been writing some interesting articles there. All right, let's go to James in Massachusetts. James, you're up. Welcome to the show. How can I serve you today, sir?
Hey, Joshua. So I had a question about buying property at a good price. So my wife and I are considering buying a property that we may or may want to, you know, put a house on or just farm or homestead on. And essentially, I'm trying to think holistically. Like, I've heard you say that you are considering buying property or properties if the opportunity presents itself with the downturn, with distressed properties and good prices. What's your strategy for keeping an eye open? Are you looking for private sales? Are you looking at any specific listing companies? Or how do you even think about like trying to be ready for when the opportunity comes? And how do you even know when the opportunity comes?
What kind of property are you interested in investing in?
So we're mostly interested in buying either a house on a little bit more acreage than we have now, or just some acreage.
Do you have a specific geographic location chosen that you'd like to pursue?
New England.
Okay, that's pretty broad. Anything more specific?
New Hampshire.
Okay. So I think the answer to your question of where to look is going to depend on what type of property you're dealing with. So for me, if I'm interested in buying rental real estate, my plan in buying that rental real estate is going to be to focus on the type of neighborhood that I want to buy, the city that I want to buy in, and the region that I want to buy in. And so I'm laughing because as I'm recording this, I've got Facebook comments coming in about my murdery eyes. There was a listener. There was a listener in the Facebook group this last week that says, "I like Joshua's new video feed, but I can't handle it because evidently Joshua has murdery eyes, slightly murdery eyes." So I'll zoom in so you can see my my slightly murdery eyes. Forgive me. Back to property. I'm still learning how to juggle all of these. Interesting aspects. So for me, my plan is to buy single family rental houses in specific cities, and towns. And so I have a certain neighborhood type that I personally am looking for. My neighborhood type, what I've chosen is the best type of property for me, is to focus on owners, neighborhoods where there's more owners than renters, on kind of older but not too old properties, kind of in South Florida, the 1980s kind of style of construction, 1980s, 1990s, and to find houses where there's no HOA, where you have three-bedroom, two-bath houses, two-car garage, kind of just that middle, slightly over the middle range of property. So there aren't a ton of neighborhoods that fit those markets. So what I've done is I've identified the neighborhoods and then just simply gotten on an MLS list so I can keep an eye on the MLS listings for those neighborhoods. And then what I have done in the past is gone out, walk the neighborhoods. You can go walk the neighborhoods, knock on doors, find out if there's, you know, anything for sale, talk to the neighbors, things like that. But that's a very specific strategy based upon the kind of thing that you're looking for. Now, if you're looking for farmland and you say, "I'd like raw land that's maybe 50 to 100 acres, that's going to be a totally different scenario. In that case, I'd be on LandWatch. I'd be driving around in the counties, talking to people, getting on some real estate agent lists, basically doing anything you can think of that's going to lead to that property eventually coming to you. But there's a dramatic difference between finding a single family house, between finding a condo for sale, between finding a bunch of land. And what I would say is the first thing you should do is work out your strategy of what you want to do. And then, if necessary, talk to some real estate agents and say, "Listen, if you were looking for this kind of property, how would you find it? What list would you get on? Where would you look for it?" And then follow their advice for your local network. That's what I would do.
Okay, cool. That's more or less what I was expecting. I didn't know if there were any special sort of hand-to-hand techniques that you would recommend, but that I think going into the communities that I'm interested in and narrowing down makes a lot of sense. So, all right, thanks a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure. I do think what you should do for whatever your chosen area of focus is look at the information that's publicly available. Look for the properties that are listed on the MLS. Look for the properties that are listed on LandWatch or on the internet on some random site. But I think it's also worth it to go and get involved in the community and try to find, put shoe leather on sidewalk, put rubber under the tires, or I guess road under the rubber, whatever idiom we want to come up with. But the idea is your best deals are probably not going to be advertised. Sometimes they are, but most real estate investors have developed their own source of high quality property, and they've figured out a way to gain access to that property before there's a lot of competition. So to this day, there are lots of people who go out and knock on doors, and it really is an effective technique. So if there's knocking on doors, if it's going to local auctions, if it's going to the sale barn and talking to farmers and saying, "Do you know anybody who's selling their property?" All of those would be good strategies. But you do want to use the lists, but you want to find the properties that aren't on the list as well. We go to Daniel. Daniel, welcome to the show. How can I serve you today, sir?
Hello, Joshua. Can you hear me?
Yes, sounds good, sir.
All right. So my question is concerning my parents. Right now, they're in the early 50s. Combined, they earn more than 150K a year. Okay. They have one apartment in Eastern Europe and also one piece of land that's been laying vacant for over a decade. So it's not for living, it's for, I guess, vacation homes, but they can't do anything with it at the moment. And my question is basically, they're not really financially educated. They come from a like communist background, and the attitude is basically, well, the money is here right now, that's good, and we give handouts to the family back home, even if the relatives have like failing businesses for years and the money is never coming back. So they're quite generous in that way, but I'm just afraid they're not taking care of their next 10, 20 years where they could. Like right now, they're in the best position, they're earning well. But how should I approach that? What I did so far is over like half a year, I got them to go to a wealth center, make an appointment. They got some tips how to optimize their taxes and so on. But I know that they could do much more. But since it's coming from me, like the son, I can't tell them really how to do it. I can just tell them, hey, look into it. There is much you can optimize because things are not going to stay the same and you are not going to earn this much money in a couple of years. So now you have the chance to set yourself up for retirement. And I'm not too sure if in 10 years the world is going to be as rosy as it is right now. And maybe they expected I'm going to be like handing out things as well in 10 years. So this is kind of the situation. I don't know if that's enough for you to make some comments, or should I add something more?
Do they have any kind of retirement plan, a government pension, a pension from their job?
Not from the job, but from the government, yes.
Do you have reason to think that that would be insufficient for them?
I'm just not trusting in that.
Right.
Yes.
How much money do you think they could save out of their income based upon their current lifestyle?
From what I heard, they could save my dad's salary, which is more than 10K a month.
That's a lot.
They could do that. They could do that. They could live off the salary of my mom, which is half of that, or less than half.
All right.
They're not doing it.
What are they doing with the money instead?
Just, you know, handouts, or just putting it in the bank, or spending it in restaurants. They're not spending much, so they're thrifty and looking for cheap deals still, like they did 15, 20 years ago. But they're, back then, they were keeping book of everything they spent, and since they were earning much more, they didn't do that anymore because, well, the money's here, so now we can just do whatever. So, yeah.
Well, when you have somebody in this situation, I think of it in a number of different approaches. So throughout human history, what's the most common way that people have retired? The most common way that people have retired throughout human history has always been based upon people. It's been based upon living with your children. It's been based upon living with somebody in the community. And so just because your parents are not skilled at saving money doesn't mean that they're destitute. It doesn't mean that they are without options. If they're building relationships in the community, they have friends, they have a network of family. That's been throughout the millennia the primary solution that most people have relied on for their retirement needs. Now, the second thing is they do have a government pension or an employer pension or a government pension. And so that's good because it gives them some basic level of support. All around the world, there are millions of people who, without the government pension, Social Security in the United States, whatever the version is within your local country, without that, they would have no savings because they've fundamentally not been trained to save money. And so they're probably going to be okay between their government pension and also you and possibly other siblings that you might have. You wouldn't let your parents, you know, go homeless and starve on the street. What you do see, however, is an opportunity that if they could learn some skills of financial management, they could dramatically increase their opportunities. They have the ability to save $10,000 a month, and with this ability to save $10,000 a month, they could become very, very wealthy. So I would do a few things. I think that there are a number of things that you could do. And to begin with, what I would try to focus on is I would try to lay out for them what they could do and how they could genuinely, massively increase their possibilities of wealth if they actually invest it. So let's just assume that they're in their early 50s. Let's just say 50 for the sake of easy math. Let's say they have 15 years of retirement, and they could save $10,000 pay. Did you say per month or per year?
If they wanted to, they could do it per month.
Okay. So what I would focus on... go ahead.
Maybe if it's... if they didn't want to cut too dramatically, 5K is reasonable. Let's say between 5 and 10.
Okay. So let's say 5,000 because it's a little bit more believable probably for them. So I would sit down and running on a financial calculator right now, $5,000 per month. So we do $5,000 per month, 15 years, and let's just say that they could earn, 6% interest. Starting with nothing, at the end of 15 years, if they could save $5,000 per month, they could potentially have $1,454,000 saved, almost $1.5 million at 6%. So to me, I would sit down with them and start by saying, listen, mom and dad, I know that you grew up under communism. I know that you didn't start by focusing on money and investment, but there's tremendous opportunity here. And yeah, you think that you couldn't build wealth, but if you could save $5,000 per month, and if you could invest it at 6% over the next 15 years, you could become genuinely wealthy within that period of time, which would be really, really remarkable. So I would start by that and see if they're interested. Now, what I think you need to be cautious of with someone like that is by making sure they choose an investment plan or an investment product that's going to be a good fit for them. And those of us who are more knowledgeable about investing often go to the products that we would choose without realizing that these products or these plans are probably not right for them. So for example, we'll often go to an aggressive stock portfolio. And a lot of times when you're in a situation like that for your parents, they couldn't handle the volatility. And so maybe you would go into some kind of term deposit and just get them invested into bank accounts. Maybe you would go into some kind of bond portfolio. What I would try to do, especially since they already own some property, I would try to get them to buy some more real estate. If they bought a couple of simple flats in the middle of town, in a good area, in the town that they live, there's a decent chance that in most places in the world, that's probably not a losing investment. That's probably a place where they could break even. And in time, if they choose well and you guide them towards maybe like a city center apartment, that could be the kind of investment that could pay income. And the nice thing about real estate is it's more intuitive, I think, for most investors, where they don't have to worry about, figuring out how to hold on through the difficult times. They just spend the rent payments. And so at $5,000 per month, if they could save $5,000 to $10,000 per month, they could probably just pay cash for an apartment every, year, 2 years, depending on what market in Eastern Europe they're in or where you're living. And I think that would be really appropriate. So I would probably try to go in that direction. I would say, mom, dad, look, if you were to buy 4 or 5 apartments in, the downtown area or help them choose a good neighborhood where they already live, figure out the prices of those apartments, and then lay it out and show them if you could buy one apartment every other year and that apartment pays us maybe $800 a month or $1,000 a month or 15, whatever your market is, that's a really good, strong financial plan, and they have enough money that they could do it. So that's where I would go, is I would try to keep it super simple, save money in the bank, buy paid off apartments, something like that.
Okay. One thing, that the apartment they bought it for when they would go back to visit the family, and I told him for like 5 years, why don't you rent it out? It's not like 98% of the year it's standing empty. Mm-hmm. And our aunt is living in the same house, so she could take care of people going in or out or whatever if it's Airbnb, but they decided not to rent it out. So that's one thing that they still have to understand. That's one thing. And the other that you talked about choosing the right investment, maybe you could answer this as well. Like, they're Christian, and my mom always says making money with money is unethical, it's like usury, it's against the commandments and stuff like that. I don't know if she really believes that, or she just says that to not do the hard work of researching financial stuff. But these are like also some mental blocks that they have against these things. So maybe your take on that.
Do they invest in anything?
They invested in some stocks at the peak of the tech bubble, and that's break even after 20 years. So it was down for like 2 decades, and they always joke about that a little bit, but it was not much. It was not much. And my dad chose some single biotech stocks, but that's just random stuff. So they don't really know what they're doing. And they burnt their fingers a couple of times, so they're not really doing anything.
Yeah, that's fairly common with people who are not particularly experienced with stock investing. What is the Christian tradition that they're a part of? Is there a denomination? Is there a tradition? Name of a church?
It's just a Roman Catholic.
Okay, Roman Catholic. So there are... That's probably a bigger question than we can tackle here, because there are definitely religious convictions that are going to affect somebody, and you've got to work within that. Now, there are almost two ways of working with that. The first way is you can say, you have this conviction and it's wrong, right? So maybe if I had a different conviction and I'm sitting and talking with somebody and they say, I'm Roman Catholic, this is what I believe, this is what I believe the Bible teaches, and I'm willing to use the authority of Scripture, well, then I would go to Scripture and start talking through that. Of course, Roman Catholic, there would be the authority of Scripture and also the authority of the church tradition and the church teaching. And so we would talk through that and discuss it from a theological perspective and try to understand if there were a way that they could change their theology. Maybe it's possible, maybe it's not. I have friends of mine who are very fundamentalist, and when, for example, Jesus says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, they understand that to be a woodenly literal fundamentalist command of Jesus, and they are very diligent about not laying up for themselves treasures on earth. They don't save money, they don't try to stack up wealth. I respect that, you know, and so I don't try to change them. I try to create a financial plan within that context. And there you often go back to community, the power of community, because in those kinds of traditions, what you have is you have a community that works together to support one another. So it's not that people who understand that to be the proper interpretation of the words of Christ, it's not as though they just go and spend all their money. What they do is they invest into the community, and the community cares one for another. And so there are ways to do it. So that's the second way, is that let's say that I'm not going to change their theology. I'm not going to persuade them that you're wrong and I'm right, or you just have a flawed understanding. I would just try to understand the extent of what do you understand the restrictions to be. There's not a strong, there's no, that I'm aware of, there's no official Roman Catholic teaching against investing. Okay. Now there are...
That's what it seems, that they just use it as an excuse not to look into it. That's my understanding of it. They're not really saying, well, this is a part of the Scripture that tells it. They're not praying every day, so they just go to church once a week. So that, I think they're pretty educated, And they would respond well if somebody laid out to them the numbers and all of that. So I think that approach would work.
Yeah. What I would do is I would try to find, are you Roman Catholic yourself? Do you share that tradition?
I grew up like that, but it's more like a cultural thing. I'm not a fundamentalist.
Okay. So what I would do is I would try to find some Roman Catholic, oriented resources. If somebody hasn't created it, then I'm sure I have a listener that can and should. But I'm sure somebody out there is teaching about finance from a Roman Catholic perspective, who understands. I'm not an expert on Roman Catholicism. I'm not Roman Catholic. And so, but I'm sure there is somebody out there who's done that. There are many Roman Catholic writers who would have written books on money. And so I would try to find that, understand a little bit about where they're coming from, and then work within the constraints of their doctrinal commitments. That's what I would do. But there's no, that I'm aware of, there's no strong Roman Catholic tradition or prohibition against lending money. The comments on usury, you can go back and look at it and think about it. But I think probably there, Gary North would be the best guy. Read his commentaries on usury. If somebody is actually interested in the biblical approach and in dealing with the Old Testament laws on usury, Gary North's writings there would probably be the best place to start. But I would just try to understand what their constraints are and then try to build a financial plan that is sensitive to those constraints. That may be term deposits in the bank. For some people, it may be just investing in other people. And I think that that's a worthy thing to do. I think there are a lot of 50-year-olds that if a financial planner came to them and said, what we're going to do with your money is we're going to use it and we're going to open an orphanage and we're going to invest your money into the orphanage and build a system of caring for the children who are fatherless here in our city, as far as I'm concerned, that's a great retirement plan. And the children in the community would be happy to provide for them on the other end of the day. So those are my answers. Anything else, Daniel?
Yeah, I think that's good. Thank you very much. Thanks for the work you do.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
All right, we go to Jason in Texas. Jason, welcome to the show. How can I serve you today, sir?
Hey, sorry to call in late. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I had a quick question. I don't know if you've done a podcast on children's insurance or adding a rider to your current insurance for a newborn. But we're expecting our first this fall, and just was wondering if you could expand on kind of your thoughts on child insurance and what to see there.
I've covered it in the context of Q&A shows here and there. I'll do it briefly. I intend, as soon as I can, I intend to come out with a standalone course where I can teach through some of the details. But I'll go ahead and give you a short answer here. And I'm going to mute you out, Jason, for a minute just to keep the audio clear. So when it comes to children's life insurance, there are a few different reasons as to why people would want it. The first reason that some people think about is burial cost. So I have a child, the child dies, and I need to provide for them. Well, I need money to be able to pay for a funeral, to buy a casket, and to go ahead and pay for those costs. That's one thing. Another aspect would be maybe things like recognizing that I've there would be hard for me to go to work. If one of my children died, it's hard for me to imagine that I'd be here on the microphone the next day. So maybe a time of emotional adjustment for the family. There are other things that you can consider. So for example, some people would say if a child died, then my financial expenses are based upon the investments that I have made into those children. If I've bought, I paid for their early child education, I've invested in their schooling, I've paid for private school for 12 years of private school, and then I paid for college, it wouldn't be unusual for a parent to have invested six figures or multiple six figures into their children. And then all of a sudden that child dies. Well, that's a real loss. It's certainly an emotional loss, but there's also a real financial loss that's associated with that. And so people might say, I've lost the money. I need to be recouped for some of that. In many cultures around the world, children are a primary, as we were talking about earlier, children are a primary form of a retirement plan, a security plan for the parents. You'll see this if you're coming from the United States, where you most often see this is in Indian communities in the United States, where it's like the mom and dad will pour out everything for their children. They'll pay for everything, get their parents, their children to the best schools possible. And then on the flip side, they're expecting that their children will support them as they get older. Also very common in Latin communities. So all of these have a financial cost that's associated with it, that you're actually talking about the money involved. And so that's the first step of insurance. Now, when it comes to these, almost nobody is really comfortable dealing with some of these costs. Most people, it's such an emotionally heavy issue that they think, if my child died, I appreciate that that might be important, but I'm not going to want to profit off of that. I'm not so bothered by the emotion of it. I don't have any emotional, you know, fear of death. It's a fact of life. And I think it's important to point some of these things out. Now, the burial cost to me seems not particularly important, at least for most of my clients and most of my listeners. You know, it's not that much to bury somebody. It costs a few thousand dollars to bury somebody, and you can save the money. So you can easily self-insure through that. An emotional adjustment, same exact thing. You can self-insure. It's not hard to self-insure through that as well. If you have a three-month emergency fund, or if you have a six-month emergency fund and you can't work for a few months because you're grieving the loss of your child, well, you can self-insure through that as well. The financial investment side of it certainly is kind of more relevant. I think it's worth thinking about, but I've almost never met a parent who is excited about talking to me about, you know, recouping the financial investment on their child. So it is valuable to have insurance on the child for those reasons, but most people genuinely can self-insure. It's not that big of a financial commitment. And so insurance is not always the perfect fit for it. It's one of those optional fits. And so the other thing is, what about insurance for the benefit of the child? So do you want insurance for the child so that in the future, in case something happens with the child, that they can adjust, that they can own their own insurance policy? Maybe they start working as a maybe they start working as a professional stunt pilot in their middle 20s. Well, they're going to have a hard time getting life insurance. So you need life insurance for that. Well, when you start to do this analysis, what you'll find is that different types of insurance policies are appropriate in different solutions. So term life insurance, if it were available, would cover the burial cost. Term life insurance, if it's available, covers emotional adjustment. And term life insurance, if available, covers the financial investment. The problem is you can't buy term insurance. You can't buy term for those who are less than 18 years old. So I do think that term insurance makes a lot of sense if you have a child that you're sending off to college. When I used to sell life insurance, I had a couple of clients who they would be sending their child off to school. They knew where they were getting set up for $150,000 of cost, or possibly in some cases $150,000 of debt. And one of the things that we would do is we would buy a couple $100,000 term life insurance policy on the child when the child was getting ready to go off to school. But the child has to be at least 18 years old. If you want term life insurance for children under 18, it's generally only available as a rider on another policy. So this might be a group policy at your job, where you can go into your job and you can add $5,000 or $10,000 of coverage there. Sometimes it can be available as a rider on an individual term life insurance policy, or as a rider if you have like all your auto insurance and home insurance and a little bit of term life insurance with a company. Sometimes they'll offer those kinds of riders, but it's not common when you get into real term life insurance. If you got a $2 million term life insurance policy with Guardian, 30, and they're not going to give you a term life insurance policy. It just don't, they don't write them for children under the age of 18. Now, when you get to insurance for the child, that's when you move over into the world of whole life insurance. And whole life insurance can also cover some of those same needs. So you can do whole life and use whole life insurance for the burial. You can use whole life insurance for the emotional adjustment. What you often can't use whole life insurance for, because it's just too expensive, is if you're going to buy a lot of it for the child. So what I recommend, just to cut right to the actual recommendations, for the vast majority of families, what I recommend is if you have access to a term life insurance policy, then go ahead and put a rider on it. If they'll give you a rider, then add a rider. A rider is so cheap, it's just not going to be a problem. And that will cover the needs that you have for the burial fund and an emotional adjustment fund. There's no reason not to go ahead and have a rider. If you do need something where you're trying to have something more permanent, you're going to wind up buying some kind of whole life insurance policy. And I really do like, as long as you have other savings, other investments as well, where you're not just saying this is going to be my ticket to wealth, because it's not. Whole life insurance policies for children do not perform well for cash value for the first 20 years. It's brutal in terms of the actual cash value. They perform much worse than whole life insurance policies for adults do from the cash value perspective. But what I do is, for all of my children, when they're 2 weeks old and I can get a policy, I buy a small whole life insurance policy for them. And what I do is I buy something, you know, you can, the figures can vary. If you have $1 million of life insurance on you, then you might get, you know, $25,000 on the child, on each of your children. If you've got millions of dollars and you have a lot of income, you know, you might get $100,000, something like that, for your children. But with those, I buy traditional whole life insurance. So it'll be in force forever. And what I do is I make sure that I add two important benefits to that policy. The first benefit is an APB, which is called an additional purchase benefit. And what an additional purchase benefit allows is it allows the insured to buy more insurance at a certain age. So for example, with my children's policies, at the age of 20, at the age of 23, 26, 29, 32, 35, 38, and 41, they can buy additional amounts of insurance. And I think I've got $100,000, it's either $100,000 or $150,000 APB on those policies. So that means that if my child turns 20, and maybe my child has some kind of disease that they can't get any life insurance, they could buy another $100,000 of whole life insurance. It'll be expensive because it's whole life insurance, but it's better than nothing if they've developed some kind of disease. More likely, they may have started doing something that's risky. So for example, I got a family member who's a pilot and started flying as a private pilot and became a professional pilot. That kind of thing gets you some big ratings a lot of times on life insurance. And so the nice thing is that with an additional purchase benefit and this kind of insurance setup, then your child is protected, where they always have the ability to buy more amounts of life insurance. Caveat, it is going to be whole life insurance. You can't do this with term life insurance, but that can still be, work out really well for them to at least have some life insurance coverage. The other thing that I always put on the policies is a disability waiver of premium. And so what that means is if the child is disabled, then you don't have to pay the premiums for them. And so that's a big, big deal, because there are certain kinds of presumptive disabilities that the child can get. And if they're disabled, you don't have to pay the premiums. But with the premier companies, the premium companies, if the child is disabled, they'll actually keep on there the additional purchase benefit. And they'll let the child buy, they'll pay for the additional purchase benefits when they come available to them. And so what I do is split the difference on these, and I buy whole life insurance policies, relatively small, for each of my children. So that they have some insurance. If they die, I've got some money to cover burial costs, etc. I've got some cash value, but the cash value returns are really bad on these kinds of policies. Basically, if it breaks even, that's good in terms of over the course of 20 years, something like that. But they'll always have some insurance that's in force. And with the additional purchase benefit, I feel like that's a really huge benefit and help, because it allows me or my children to buy more insurance in the future. So that's kind of the fast lesson on it, Jason. Oop, hold on. This Jason, I unmuted the wrong person. Any follow-up questions, Jason?
One last one. As far as life insurance on myself. My wife will be quitting her job once we have kids, and we'll have a household income of about $100K. I currently have $250 on myself and $250 on my wife. Would you recommend upping that once we have a kid?
Are you financially independent? Do you have millions of dollars in savings?
No.
Okay. So yes, you can do a needs analysis, and that's the proper way to do it. You calculate how much money you would need if you died, how much debt you would want to pay off, how much income your family would need, and then you subtract all your assets that are available. So the proper way to do it is to perform a proper needs analysis. And this is Life Insurance 101. Talk to any life insurance agent. They can do that for you. What you will find out is it's going to be somewhere between 10 to 20 times your annual income. That's always where it is. If you actually sit down with 100 people, with 98 of them, it'll be somewhere between 10 to 20 times your life, and your annual income. So you'll be at somewhere between $1 million to $2 million of total coverage for you. And I would buy, if your wife is going to be a stay-at-home mom, I would buy minimum half of that for her. I would buy more if she's still working and she can qualify. She won't be able to qualify as a stay-at-home mom for the same amount that you can qualify for. So what you want to do is at an early age, while she's still working and can financially qualify for more insurance, go ahead and get more. So, you know, where you're going to wind up when you do that needs analysis with an insurance agent is you're going to wind up doing $1.5 million on you and $750,000 or $1 million on her. But the great thing is, if you guys are relatively young, non-smokers, this is a total net cost with, you know, for you to have $1.5 million is probably $40 a month for term life insurance. And for her to have $750,000 is probably, you know, $30 a month. And I'm not going to explain it right now, but buy a type of life insurance called annual renewable term life insurance. Do not buy level term life insurance when you're under the age of about 45. So if you're in your 30s, buy annual renewable term life insurance, and you can go and investigate that elsewhere.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. All right, that was Jason. I've got too many callers here. Let's go to the Florida Keys. Welcome to the show. How can I serve you today?
Hey, good morning, Joshua. John here. I'm going to stick with the theme of this episode. It seems like real estate. I got a decision to make and was looking for your insight.
Okay.
So I'm currently active duty military, and I just received what will be my final set of orders, taking me back to New Orleans, Louisiana, where I intend to retire. I was there previously during my career, and I already have one rental property there in Louisiana. So the decision is now we're looking at, the orders are three-year orders, but we know this is our long-term desired location to stay at. So do we buy another 3-2 for a second rental property, or do we go and look to make the decision to buy that longer 5 to 10 year forever home, so to speak?
Do you have children?
One child and one on the way.
Okay. How old is your child that you have?
She's 3.
Yeah. I would buy a rental first. I would buy a house that's a good rental. With a 3-year-old, the good thing is she's kind of right at that cusp where you're going to start to appreciate some of the amenities. But I would buy the rental first, and maybe even two over the next 3 years, and live in them, you know, while you're there, live in them and then rent them out. Do the nomad investing strategy. Read James Orr's book and kind of let that be your inspiration. But I would do the rentals first. And then, you know, if you have another child, if you move into kind of the long-term house when you have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, that would be really ideal. I would go ahead and build that rental property portfolio first, and then have that ticking away there before I move to the forever home. Because you guys are used to moving. You know you've got to move. You've got a 3-year-old, doesn't need that much space. You're going to have a baby, doesn't need that much space. If you'll stretch it out for another 3 years, purchase one or two rentals in the interim, then you'll be much on a much higher financial independence trajectory than you would be if you go ahead and move to the big house, you get comfortable, you start, you know, settling in, doing that nesting thing. Defer it just a little bit till you have more houses and then go ahead and make that lifestyle upgrade. That's what I would do.
Sounds what we were thinking about doing, and I appreciate your insight there, Joshua.
Yeah. I think it's important to acknowledge that you don't want to live like a pauper forever. Your goal is not to kind of always be stuck in this place where we're just going to move and it's money, 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 money. It's nice to set up that home base, that nest, that forever home. Your wife is going to be thrilled when you're done with the military. She doesn't have to worry about moving 2 years from now. But it's a lot nicer to do that if you've got a good, solid financial base. And so I would definitely just defer it a little tiny longer, and you'll get more benefits out of it when you are settled. What book I'd recommend, if you haven't read it, it's available free online, but search for James Orr, and it's called Nomad Real Estate Investing. And he has that book available online for free, but it's basically the strategy of buy a house, move into it, live there for a year or so, and then move out and do it again. And you can do this with your VA loans. There's a little bit of trickiness with regard to the technicalities of how many VA loans you're supposed to have. You can investigate that, but there are a lot of people who have used the VA loans, purchased a large rental estate portfolio of multiple properties, and it seems that it's something that they've been able to do. So that would be my approach. All right, let's go to Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to the show. How can I serve you today?
Hey, Josh. My name is Steven. I was just hollering actually on a somewhat similar topic. I'm 27 years old, got two kids and a wife, and we live in Tennessee, actually.
Okay.
I'm joining the military in September as an officer, and that will produce a significant increase in salary just because I'm only just now getting into being physically responsible with my personal finances. We have four goals: to pay off student loans, adopt a child, buy real estate back in Tennessee for when we get out of the military, and begin savings. Do you have any resources you would recommend for how I strategize accomplishing those goals, considering I'm going to see a pay increase, but I'm just trying to figure out how to maneuver on that. So,
well, the first thing I would do is save money. It's never a wrong thing to save money. So that would be priority number one. I would live on the minimum that is comfortable for your family and save the maximum amount of money. Now, with regard to student loans, I would think carefully through my overall strategy. Am I going to pay them off? And is that going to help me? Or is it more strategic for me to keep them and invest the money as well? Should I pay off the debt or should I invest? I've got an entire episode on that. Just go back in the archives of Radical Personal Finance and you'll find that episode, and you can think through that. But I would, especially in an environment like now where they'll give you deferrals, they'll freeze the interest, etc., I would build up a big savings account. And if you're going to move in the direction of buying real estate, then, you know, this is probably going to be a good time to buy. Now, with regard to having a child, I would say this is time dependent, not money dependent. So, sorry, with adopting a child. So I would not wait on the money to adopt a child. If I knew I wanted to have a child, we would adopt the child. When the child is available, when we see the opportunity and we say, this is the child that we want to adopt, I would do it. I think it's, although I appreciate that it seems sensible to try to wait on big life decisions until you've got the money thing all figured out. You know, there's people who, especially in the FIRE community, it's all about, I'm going to be financially independent by the time I'm 30 and have children. I personally have come to the conclusion that those things are life decisions that are more important than money. Do you need to be able to afford it? Yes. But a lot of times, you know, if I didn't have the money and I felt the desire to adopt a child, I would pursue the adoption and wait for the money to show up. Maybe I worked it. Maybe I did a deal. Maybe friends and family donated money. Maybe I was able to find some discounts. I just would not wait on money to get married, would not wait on money to have children. I would make those decisions because I felt the time was right. And then I would make the money make sense over time. So in my order would be savings, because you can do that now. Adoption would be whenever it's appropriate. Number three would be real estate, when I find the deal. And then number four would be student loans. And if you're going to be, you know, aggressive about building a real estate portfolio, you have to do that when the property is available and when they're a good deal. Now, if you can pay off the student loans quickly and be debt-free, that can go now. It can go after savings. It can go at anywhere along the line. That's the big question mark. But I don't. That's how I would order them myself.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I'm tracking with you. Sounds like it's almost more of a what are my personal priorities rather than, you know, and having savings helps to accomplish a lot of those. So
right.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Good. My pleasure. All right. We're going to go a little bit faster. I've got Indiana, Minnesota, and Texas, and then maybe back to Daniel. Nope. Daniel, we're done. Indiana, welcome to the show. How can I serve you today?
Hey, Joshua. I am a doctor looking to join a new group. They currently offer a 401k, but no match on it, and I was talking to them about that. They would like to offer a match to the doctors. I think it'd be too expensive to offer the match to everyone. Is there a way to set up your 401k so that you can offer a match to certain physicians but not others?
No.
No, there's not. Okay. Well, that somebody in the Facebook group had mentioned something about setting up an affiliated services group. Is that something you're familiar with? A way to potentially get through with that?
The idea being of an affiliated services group, the idea is that if you set up a separate company that is focused on, you know, that employs the doctors, but then a different company that employs the staff. Is that the idea?
That's my understanding of it, yes.
So is it technically possible? I would say most likely. It is technically possible. But the important thing is to understand that there's still restrictions. So if you have companies that have common ownership, so let's say that I own a company called Company A, and my wife and I are the sole employees of Company A. We pay ourselves $200,000 per year. And then I also own, and my wife and I own Company B, and in Company B, we have five low-level staff that all get paid $20,000 per year. Well, in that situation, we're not going to be able to just set up a 401k in Company A, but not in Company B, because the companies have common ownership. So could you set up some kind of affiliated services group where there was just an employment in that separate company and there were different ownership than the low-level group? Yes. But you're going to need to talk to a specialist who will follow the rules very carefully, because the number one thing that's important to the government with regard to 401k plans is non-discrimination. They do not want 401ks used to set up extra special benefits for high-level, highly compensated employees to the detriment of the low-level staff. And so that's the doctrine that is hammered through every single part of the code in every qualified plan, be it a 401k or some other qualified plan. You cannot discriminate in favor of highly compensated employees and key owners. So as long as you study those laws, it is theoretically possible to set up multiple companies and do that. My answer to you is it's probably not going to be worth it. And you need to know that you better button it up exactly in the right way, because if you don't, you're dealing in an area that they're very serious about. And so you're going to need professional advice. You need to make sure that you have all of the T's crossed and the I's dotted.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Anything else?
I've got a separate question.
Go ahead.
That's completely unrelated, if you've got time.
Go ahead.
So my wife and I are expecting our first child in December. I've really appreciated a lot of your philosophies on child raising, and you've kind of expanded a lot of, what I think about as possible to children. Do you have any recommendations on resources for a new parent? Books you've read, classes, anything like that, that you think a new parent should be looking into?
So I would say the first thing is, with regard to having a new child, is going to be to think about the birth of the child. I've got a lot about the child, but what I'll do for the sake of this Q&A show is I'll focus on the birth, and I'll just kind of give you my standard new father speech of, hey, congratulations, you're expecting a baby. Now let's talk about some things that you need to know and the things that you need to consider, just purely from my experience. You're a doctor, I'm not, but I'll give you some things from my experience. What I would say is your first priority with regard to your new child is certainly to have a safe birth of your child, but to work with your wife with the goal of having a healthy, enjoyable, safe, natural childbirth. And that's one of the most important things that you can do for the child, one of the most important things that you can do for your wife, one of the most important things that you can do for your family. And there are a lot of things that you can do to work towards those goals. But in order for you to do them, I think you're going to have to, what I've learned, is you got to be a little bit countercultural, because in the West, we have a strange view of childbirth, that childbirth is somehow a medical emergency and a medical mm-hmm. event, and therefore we need tons and tons of medical intervention. So the first thing that I would do if I were you is apply your medical knowledge and study childbirth and study kind of the different trends. Kind of the classic place to start would be, there's an older documentary that I forget the name of the lady that did it, but I think it's usually the place that I encourage people to start. The Business of Being Born is a good documentary to start with. There are a bunch of books that are good. There's a book called The Business of Baby that might be interesting to you. And so you want to consider carefully the childbirth process. Basically, my summary statement is childbirth does not have to be difficult. Childbirth does not have mm-hmm. to be painful. Childbirth does not have to be a horrific experience in most women's lives. There are some women who do have significant medical conditions, etc. And so, of course, that's unique, where you need medical intervention. But I'd encourage you and your wife to really become educated and really become knowledgeable about the process of childbirth, so that you can understand kind of what you want, and talk to her and think about, what does she want? What kind of birth experience does she want? Your three basic options that you're going to think about is, do we want a hospital birth? I would guess that that's probably almost an automatic thing for you, being a physician, but I don't think that it necessarily should be. I think you should consider other options. There are birth center births all around the United States, and then, of course, you could do a home birth. And so each of them has a different advantages and different disadvantages. What I would tell you is, I'm convinced personally that a lot of times having a hospital birth increases the risk of birth for the mother and the father, because it takes what can be a really rich and wonderful experience for the mother and father, and it turns it into a very medical event. Now, we chose with our first baby that we were going to have a birth center birth. We didn't wind up making it out of the house. I wound up delivering the baby at home, because when it was time to go, the baby was already there. And I've gone on and I've delivered all four of my babies at home with a midwife assistant. Now, we had low risk births. Everything looked great. But what we found through that experience is that for us, our experience and our memories of childbirth are some of the most intimate, really just wonderful, rewarding experiences that we ever had. And We did something that I would commend to you. There are a number of different childbirth methodologies that you can look into. We did something called hypnobirthing, which is weird and crunchy, but we really enjoyed it in terms of, and got good results from it in terms of the childbirth. And basically hypnobirthing is all about how can you learn about childbirth to the point where you can minimize and to some extent even eliminate the pain of childbirth. And so by having a child at home or in a birth center where it's a non-medical environment, what I think that has helped is it made the entire birth experience into an intimate and enjoyable just experience rather than in a medical event. And what my wife found is that she found herself feeling much safer and much more relaxed than if she were in a birthing suite at a hospital with nurses and doctors coming in and stuff strapped to her stomach and the fluorescent lights, etc. Now, in most modern birthing hospitals, what they've done is they've stripped out all the old-fashioned birthing suites and they brought in more of a home-like environment. And I think that can be a great solution. But I would really encourage you to consider kind of some other solution. We never had the confidence to have a home birth with our first baby. We wanted to have a birth center birth, and we chose a birth center that was very near the hospital so that if there were complications, we could go ahead and transfer to the hospital and have the appropriate medical intervention. But our experience has been that having a child with the use of a midwife rather than a physician, rather than just an obstetrician, just lent immeasurably to a far better experience because the midwives have so much more experience birthing a baby. It just completely transformed everything. And from a financial perspective, while none of us would ever start with saying, I'm going to think about the money, I think it's also foolish to ignore the money. And so anything you can do to minimize the risk of having a $30,000 C-section, which then generally turns into, if you have more than one child, multiple C-sections down the road, it's well worth the investment, spending the money, spending the time, and really thinking carefully about it. And so what I'd recommend to you is don't just assume because you are a physician that you know, I don't know what your specialty is, but don't assume anything about childbirth and really dig into it and work with your wife. You got plenty of time and figure out with her what is going to lead her to have the best experience. I'll give you two more pieces of advice, one mental and one physical. With most women, especially first-time mothers, the prospect of giving birth for the first time can be a very fearful experience. I don't know how many births you attended as part of your training and how many births you've been at. But for the average new father and the average new mother, they've never been to a single childbirth in their life. And so all of their impression of childbirth comes from TV. It comes from some mother, you know, splayed out on a gurney in a bright fluorescent hospital room with her legs splayed open, a bunch of strangers in the room screaming your head off. Like that's the basic picture that most new fathers and mothers have of childbirth, which is a ridiculous picture, but all that does is build fear. And so one of the things that is extraordinarily valuable is if you can help to build a plan that helps your wife release all of the fear that she has associated with childbirth, then it can help her to feel much more confident. And when she feels much more confident, then the whole experience can go much better. Now, some of that is going to be related to understanding the process of childbirth. So for example, one of the things that we were taught when we had our first child that dramatically transformed our experience and also has transformed the experience of other people I've shared this with is just physically understanding what happens with the process of birth. So most women don't have any understanding of what a contraction is. They just feel like a contraction is this stunning bit of pain where all of a sudden they just can't control it and they've got to go through all this pain. But a contraction is simply the natural process where the muscles of the uterus press the baby down through the birth path until it's born. And it's a natural process whereby the cervix thins and opens so that the baby can pass through the birth path. And yet it's a physical event. And so when we understood that it was a muscular event where you had, you know, the muscles of the uterus that are kind of crosshatch against each other and one pulls one way and one pulls the other way, and that gentle process over time presses the baby's head against the cervix and then in time the baby passes through, it transformed it. Because what we did was we started associating contractions with a workout. We started associating the physical pain of contractions with the kind of physical pain that you have going into the gym. So if you go into the gym and you're in there pumping iron and you're doing, you know, squats, or you're doing chest presses or benching, and all of a sudden your muscles are screaming in pain, you understand that this really hurts. But it's not this emotional, overwhelming thing that you just can't handle. And the secret solution to the pain in your quadriceps from your squats is to stick a needle in your quads and get rid of the pain. You understand, this is muscular pain that comes for a purpose. And so once we started comparing the experience of contractions to something like a really intense, really difficult workout, it changed the emotional experience for my wife, and allowed her to use some of the tools and skills to manage the pain and not be emotionally debilitated by it, feeling like she had to have a needle stuck in her spine to somehow get through it. And so little things like that, I've found when I've talked to other expectant mothers and fathers and explained it, and they come back later and said, that was so valuable. Another simple thing that we did was, and this was part of the hypnobirthing curriculum if you choose to go through that, but we did this kind of fear release exercise where I had my wife write down all of the things that she was scared about, and then we made a plan for them. So I'm, of course, sharing intimate details, but it's not, I don't think it's a bad thing here, but like, my wife was scared of being pressured. She hates to be pressured or to be hurried. She despises being hurried. And so she didn't want to feel any pressure about the baby coming, especially on the due date, so to speak. The natural range when a baby is expected is a 4-week range. It's anywhere from 38 to 42 weeks. That's normal. That's the normal range. And of course, it's different for a first time childbirth versus a later childbirth. But what happens for a lot of mothers is they say, hey, my baby is due on June 1st. And all of a sudden on June 1st, all their friends start saying, is the baby here? Is the baby here? Then on June 2nd, is the baby here? And her mother-in-law says, hey, is there any news? Is there any news? And then by June 7th, the poor mom is so freaked out by everyone saying, where's the baby and what's wrong and is everything okay, that she can hardly relax and enjoy things. When the reality is, the normal expected time is anywhere from May 15 to June 15. And as long as you're getting appropriate medical care through that period, the baby's being monitored, making sure that the baby's okay, everything's okay, that's normal. And so once I understood that that was one of my wife's fears, we did some stuff that just to get rid of it. And so, for example, when we are expecting a child, we don't tell anybody the expected due date of the child. We just don't tell anybody. The only person that needs to know is her, me, and the midwife, and our backup doctor, right? That's it. Beyond that, nobody else has any need to know. So if the baby's expected due date is June 15, we say sometime in June or July. Then you buy yourself lots of time. And is that a little bit annoying? It is. But it was one of things that just completely released my wife from all of the mental kind of fear and stress of the event. Now, there are other things as well. So just what I would encourage you is work with your wife to help her to understand what she's afraid of. And then when you release those things, then it dramatically improves the probability of having a comfortable, healthy, safe, natural childbirth. If you start talking to doulas and midwives, and they start telling you about some of the things where the woman is in labor and everything is advancing, and then all of a sudden it just stops. It's not always, and I would, now I'm not a pediatrician, I'm not an obstetrician, I'm not a midwife, I don't know. But I would say it's probably, from listening to them, it's probably a majority of the time something in the brain, something mental, where the woman is scared about something, or there's a problem in relationship, and then the childbirth process doesn't advance appropriately. And so playing the mental game is super, super important. And whatever situation is going to make your wife feel totally confident, totally at rest, that's where you need to be. And that's where you need to focus, focus your time and attention. Last thing, I am convinced that one of the important things to do during the process of childbirth is to make sure that she gets regular chiropractic adjustments, especially that her pelvis is not twisted. So I'll show on the video, but if you imagine that this is, if you hold up your hands in front of you and you make a V with your hands and you look through them, this is the bones of your wife's pelvis. And so if you tilt that and you just push one hand forward and one hand back, what you see is that it makes a dramatic difference in the amount of space that's available for the baby's head and body to pass through when the baby's head is passing through her pelvis on the birth path. And so one of the things that we've always worked really hard at is making sure that my wife receives regular chiropractic adjustments during pregnancy, especially as she's carrying that weight, especially as it's pushing lots of pressure on her bones. And that's been one of the many things that we've done to try to focus on having really successful, simple, smooth childbirth experiences. I'm convinced, of course, you can't guarantee anything. Every woman's body is different. There are many things that can happen that are out of our control. But we've always just worked and worked and worked and worked for months, just really diligently to make sure that we've done everything possible to prepare for a really comfortable, safe childbirth. And thus far, we've had four really awesome, comfortable, safe childbirths. Last thing in Joshua's kind of standard new father speech. You will spend a lot of time preparing for the childbirth. The thing that I wish someone had told me before we had our first child was it's not all done after the birth. The first few days and the first couple weeks of a new baby, especially the first baby, are really, really tough. And so we were very prepared for childbirth. What we were not prepared for was how difficult those first few days were going to be, how difficult breastfeeding was going to be, how difficult just settling into the baby was going to be. We weren't prepared for that. Now, second time, third time, fourth time around, things were a lot better. Don't think that it's all over with the birth. Focus on the birth and focus on the new mom and making sure that you've got lots of help and support and care for her. And then after your baby is a few months old, then you can start thinking about all the other stuff, all of the child raising stuff. But that stuff, there's plenty of time. Right now, focus on the childbirth and those first couple of weeks. It's a really special, awesome time. As a four-time father who has delivered all of his own babies, I recommend to you. And that's one of the last things I would say to you, is that get in there and receive your own babies. It's a really empowering experience for a father. I remember after our first baby was born, I felt like the king of the world. I felt like, I don't know how to describe it. I just felt like the king of the world. I felt like the most extraordinarily accomplished and successful man in the universe. And it was a really special experience for us. So there's Joshua's standard speech. Consider those things, work them out, do your research, and figure out what's going to make for the best experience for both of you. And you really can, in a majority of cases, transform something that some people fear, some people dread, into some of the richest, closest experiences that you and your wife can experience together.
Well, thank you for that. I'm definitely very interested in the not hospital approach. I definitely was, you know, looking at birth tourism. She's really not on board with that, so, you know, so we follow what she wants, obviously. But yeah, you gave me some good things to look into with the business being born, hypnobirthing, and looking at some of the other options that are out there. So I'll definitely forward that along to her and let her kind of look at some of the other stuff.
I love birth tourism. Birth tourism is awesome. I cannot imagine how we ever could have done it with our first child. I've talked to parents who've done it. It's amazing. But I would not, even as much as I like birth tourism, when I think back to what it was like for the first baby, I wouldn't want to be anywhere except home. I want to be at home. I'd want to be at home where our family can be there, our friends. To me, I think that's just more valuable than a passport. So whatever is going to make her comfortable is where you got to focus. But do the research. I'm convinced that you'll find the right solution. All right, I am going to go rapid fire here. Let's see. Corey in Minnesota, I'm going to answer your question in 2 minutes or less. If it's worse than that, if it's bigger than that, then we're going to move it to next week. So go fast. Go ahead, Corey. All right, Corey is right there. Oh, Corey is down, just came back. Corey, go ahead. I can't hear you. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go fast with your question, please.
Okay. Basically, I just wanted to know, I've got about $80,000 in sort of cash, basically emergency fund, maybe possibly some of it for real estate at some point, but I'm currently sitting in partially checking account, partially like high interest, not high interest, 1.5%, you know, online savings account. Just wondering, I heard on your last show kind of talk a little bit about emergency funds with credit card and life insurance and things like that. Just thoughts on kind of where to keep that money and how to structure that.
I have a podcast episode in the history of Radical Personal Finance. Stand by and I will tell you what number, but it's called Where Should You Keep Your Emergency Fund? And that will answer the question. So stay on the line. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the next question, and at the end of the show, I will mention the answer to that question. But go listen. I'll tell you the show number, and go listen to that show. We'll go down to Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show. How can I serve you today, please? Pennsylvania.
Hello, Joshua.
Go ahead.
Hey, I have a simple question. You talk every now and again about recently you mentioned or bread, where they bake and deliver the hood. And I've read about, getting out. I guess here's kind of what I'm envisioning. I've got little kids. My kids are very, very young, 4, 2, and 1 right now. And I would like to teach them life lessons through running their own business, teach them just what it looks like. Also, I would kind of like to find a way at an early age to, through a family business or whatnot, to have them have some earned income so I could start teaching them, money skills and investing and even having the ability to open a Roth IRA for them while they're under 10, which just is appealing to me. So, I just kind of wanted to ask you from we have some things that we do. We're not really bakers. I do beekeeping, so we make and sell hive products. Generally, that's honey and lip balm and things like that. So just kind of your thoughts from a structure standpoint and knowing the age of my kids, what would it look like, do you think, or how do you handle that to get your kids involved in a way that is then business lessons, life lessons, money lessons, but also the potential of saying, hey, this is earned income, file a tax return, kiddie tax, and then have the ability to convert that into long-term savings for them.
It's important to me. I think it is well worth doing. I've got a lot of ideas on it. The short version that I would encourage you is start by thinking about the kind of business that would be fun to do, that would also be profitable, and that would build in just some pathways where the children can genuinely be involved. And what I'll say is call in next week and remind me at the beginning of next week's Q&A, and I'll try to put you in the first spot, and we'll try to flesh out some ideas that would be useful specifically for you. Deal?
Good deal. Appreciate it.
All right. Texas, you're on. How can I serve you?
Hey, Joshua, this is Trey. I'll go quick.
Go ahead, Trey.
I'm interested in possibly converting my regular W-2 job as a director of financial operations at a health system to maybe a per diem consulting arrangement where I'd have most of my same duties but just have more time off. And I thought that you might have mentioned some benefits tax-wise as being self-employed versus receiving a W-2. I can get on my wife's insurance, so my employer would be saving my benefits cost. I'm just trying to work out a way where I can have more days off during my not busy season, which is the non-budgeting strategic plan time, and not cost my employer much more because I'd want to probably hire an analyst at a lower rate to do the more day-to-day things that I'm doing not during that busy season.
It's a good question. The first thing to think about is the actual lifestyle benefits and things like having more flexibility with your schedule can be reasons in and of themselves why you would want to do this, even if the tax stuff is a wash. When it comes to tax savings, there are two basic components. The first is possible savings on employment taxes, and the second is other tax deductions. Is there something that you would be able to deduct as an individual business owner rather than your being an employee? I'm going to give you the fast version. You need to make more money and a substantially more money as a contractor than as a W-2 employee for it to be worth it. But if you can, and especially if you can move to setting up an S corporation, then you have the option and possibility of paying some of your income out of your company as dividends rather than wages. And if you can do that, you can possibly save your employment taxes, which would be 15.3%, but currently your employer is paying 7.65%. You're paying 7.65%. So you could possibly have some savings there. In addition, there are some businesses that would fit well to significant tax deductions. So for example, maybe you could go ahead and genuinely set up a legit home office. Maybe you could go ahead and start driving your old beat up car and take a 60 cent per mile deduction on business miles that creates thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of phantom deductions. Maybe there are things you could do, travel you could take, or expenses for equipment or gear that as an employee you can't deduct, but you can deduct if you're a contractor. But at the end of the day, you need to make sure that you're going to get a better lifestyle benefit, and you need to make sure that you're going to get a decent amount more money. So what I would say is call in next week and let's talk about the specifics of your job. And once again, like I said, the previous guy, tell me when I start and I'll put you up in the number one slot next week.
All right. I'd love to do that. Thank you so much.
Good stuff. Thank you all for calling in for today's episode. What I want to close with is the thing that I mentioned as far as the episode of Where to Keep Your Emergency Fund is episode 481 of Radical Personal Finance from September 12, 2017. It's called Where Should I Keep My Emergency Fund? And it's an in-depth, detailed discussion of the answer to that question of where you should keep your emergency fund. So I would commend that episode to you if you're interested in the question. Thank you for listening to today's show. If you would like to call in to next week on the show, join at patreon.com/radicalpersonalfinance. Again, that is patreon.com/radicalpersonalfinance. And if you sign up to become a patron of the show there at patreon.com/radicalpersonalfinance, then you will gain access to these weekly Q&A shows. And hopefully I can speak with you next week. Thank you all for calling in. And there was one comment I wanted to add that I added on the screen as we go from one of the live watchers here on Facebook. Watcher says to Stephen, earlier question, joining the military gives you a number of monetary advantages that most civilians aren't aware of. Look into the SCRA and MLA specifically. Off the top of my head, the military will give you allowance to offset the cost, along with paid time off for you and the adopted child. Reddit has a decent subreddit called r/militaryfinance. Is a good place to start. Doug Nordman through the Bogleheads has a good book he wrote to get you started financially with your career. Definitely read Doug's book. I should have recommended that myself. Doug's a good friend, and he does a great job. There are a number of personal finance bloggers that are exclusively focused on the military market, and if I were in the military, I would read every blog post and every book that any of those guys had written. That's it for today's show. Thank you all for being here, and I'll be back with you very soon.